From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Lori Trahan finally ekes out a win in the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District. But did that contest make the case for ranked choice voting? Also today, the extraordinary number of women running for office across Massachusetts and the country.
Last election cycle, we had about 920 women reach out to us and say, I'd like to run for office. This cycle, we've seen more than 40,000 women reach out to us for help running for office.
Plus, what new census numbers say about the so-called Massachusetts miracle?
I think it's a bad sign. It's saying something pretty fundamental about how our economy is failing people at the bottom.
And plans for a new memorial in Boston to honor Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King.
What the King stood for is still real. It's almost as if their voices are as strong today as they were 50 years ago.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's begin today with politics and a look at the extraordinary number of women running for office here in Massachusetts and across the country and what it portends for the coming midterm elections. A case in point, Lori Trahan, the Democratic candidate for Congress running to succeed Nikki Tsongas in the state's 3rd congressional district. Today, Trahan attended a Democratic unity event a day after she was finally declared the winner of that very close Democratic primary election 2 weeks ago. After an official recount, she beat her closest competitor, Dan Coe, who conceded yesterday by just 145 votes. Trahan will face Republican challenger Rick Green, and she says she's looking forward to making her case to voters.
We're going to keep talking about increasing access to health care that people can afford. You know, there's a rising cost of living that our wages are not keeping up with, an opioid crisis that's taking too many people in our community, and an immigration enforcement that's not humane and counter to our values.
Lori Trahan is, among other things, part of an unprecedented wave of female political candidates running in Massachusetts and across the country. Consider this. In the current congressional election cycle, 50% of non-incumbent Democratic House nominees are women. 50%. That eclipses the last record of 29% back in 2016. These candidates are fired up by a number of issues, including the policies of Donald Trump. But this is not only about the president. To talk more about this, we're joined by Dave Hopkins. He's a professor of political science at Boston College. He studies American political parties and elections. Good to have you.
Great to be here, Anthony.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Julie McLean Downey. She's National Director of Campaign Communications with Emily's List, which recruits and supports women candidates. Julie, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So, Dave, let me start with you. What are we seeing here in Massachusetts in terms of the number of women running for office this season? What's striking you?
Well, what we're seeing here is very much the story we're seeing across the country. Massachusetts is sort of part of this bigger trend of more Democratic women running for office and more Democratic women winning in Democratic primaries. And we just had two really big House primaries here in the state, up in the 3rd District, as we talked about, and then also closer in the 7th District, where we had this fairly historic upset of Ayanna Pressley beating a 10-term incumbent, Mike Capuano. And in both cases, we see new, younger women winning in Democratic primaries. And it's the same story, really, from coast to coast in 2018.
We can also go back to last November. 6 women of color elected to the Boston City Council. Outside of Boston, Ruth Ann Fuller was elected first female mayor of Newton. Yvonne Spicer became not only Framingham's first female chief executive, but the city's first mayor. So what explains this? Dave, let me stick with you. Why are women running and why are they winning?
Yeah, it's an interesting story with sort of both a supply and a demand side. The supply side is just record numbers of women candidates filing for office, running active campaigns, strong, very competitive women candidates that are just strong contenders in primaries more than ever before. But then I think there's another side of it, which is that Democratic voters are looking for women candidates more than they used to. They're weighing gender and they're more interested in rectifying the historic underrepresentation of women in office more this year than they have in the past. So it's both more women running and then more women winning votes in Democratic elections.
Julie McLean Downey, let me come to you. This dynamic, as Dave mentioned, is playing out across the country. Tell us how Emily's List sees this. What are you seeing just in terms of sheer numbers?
Yeah, well, to give you a sense for how unique this cycle is, Emily's List last election cycle, which is Election Day post-2014 through Election Day 2016, we had about 920 women reach out to Emily's List and say, I want to run for office. Can you help me do that? That was a very high number for us, and we called it the Hillary bump. This election cycle, since the day after election 2016 to today, we've had more than 40,000 women reach out to us.
40,000, from 900 to 40,000. In 2 years.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, our organization has tripled the number of staff members we have working on down ballot races, because most of these women are not looking to run for governor tomorrow, but rather they are wanting to make running for office part of their long-term plans. They might not run this year, next year, or 4 years from now, but it's something that they have decided is important to them, and they want to be a voice for their community. So we saw this sort of wave of first-time candidates running for congressional office with a diversity of background and bringing unique qualifications to the jobs, including fighter pilots and former CIA operatives, nonprofit executives, these women with tremendous resumes stepping up to run, but also women just saying, I want to be a part of change in my community. At the more local level.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really up and down the ballot that we've seen this excitement about women running for office, both from the candidates themselves and also from voters.
And Julie, what's really fueling this? Is it all about Donald Trump or not?
It is not all about Donald Trump. I can say that with certainty. Having been in a lot of our candidate training rooms where we have women come and sort of spend a whole day with our staff learning about how to build a campaign, create a budget, I can tell you that they are not fans of Donald Trump. They are frustrated by Republican leadership, especially when it came to the health care battle. They did not like what they were seeing out of Washington. But that's not why they're running for school board or city council or mayor or water commissioner. They're running because they see this sort of dearth of good leadership and want to find a way to make a difference. Women, we always say at Emily's List, they don't run for office because they want to be something, but rather they want to do something.
I want to play a piece of tape. A few months back, I talked to Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards right after she was elected there. And here's what she said about why so many women like her are running.
People are confusing with saying almost like this is the time for women, when in reality, women haven't run at this level before. Right. And so I hope that people see, you know, that when women run, they can win.
So, Julie, is that sort of consistent with what you see?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, studies have shown previously that women win at the same rates as men typically, but don't always run at the same rates. And that's really why Emily's List has been such an important part of the Democratic Party's recruiting mechanism since 1985, because our staff would spend a lot of time talking to women across their kitchen tables, you know, talking to them about why they should run, why their leadership was necessary, how to put the pieces together to make a campaign successful. And that has been a big part of our role for so long. And it still is. There are still parts of this country, rural Iowa, the panhandle of Florida, where there are vacant seats and just nobody stepping up to run. And so we are recruiting women in some of these places still, but there is undoubtedly a big change in women raising their hands and saying, I'm ready, let's do this. If this guy can be president, I can run for local office.
Dave Hopkins, I want to come back to you, because on your blog, you cite data from the Pew Research Center that suggests that antipathy to Trump is very evident among a lot of these folks who are running, right?
Well, sure. I mean, Democrats in general are very mobilized this year because of their very strong dislike of the president. And from the moment that he got elected in this somewhat surprising upset 2 years ago, there's been an energy on the Democratic side that is really a mix of anger and frustration and opposition to the Trump White House. And that's what we're seeing playing out in this election, where we see Democratic turnout in primaries is way up. There are more Democratic candidates running. The Democrats are raising more money, and where they report to pollsters that they're more enthusiastic about voting in the 2018 midterms. Mm.
So what about Republican women running for office? Are their numbers up, Dave?
A little bit, but there's nothing like the revolutionary change that we're seeing in the Democratic side. Republican women are still very much underrepresented in terms of candidate pools, just as in the past.
Right. Julie, is that consistent with what Emily's list sees? In other words, are most of the women that come to you Democrats running for office, looking to run for office?
Yes, Emily's List is an organization that only deals with Democratic women, but it is a massively one-sided year for this sort of excitement around women candidates. It's been Democratic women that have been driving turnout, but also been the ones stepping up to run for office. And as the sort of chart of number of women in Congress for Democrats has gone up, the number of women Republicans has gone down. They're going to lose a big percentage of women in their caucus just due to either running for higher office or retirements at the congressional level. And we expect them to not gain much ground at all, whereas Democratic women will add to their ranks pretty dramatically.
So one of the places that we're not seeing this so-called pink wave hit is in gubernatorial races. I'm seeing that only 16 of 61 female candidates won their primaries. Julie, any theories about why that is?
Sure. I can tell you we have hit a historic number, so I would like to just make that point that we are at a record number of women as major party nominees in gubernatorial races. But it's still difficult to break through and change the perception around women as leaders in positions like governorships. Women largely are seen to have qualities that make good legislators, but it's a glass ceiling that can be difficult to break in a lot of cases still. And that's why the women who we have seen in, say, Maine and New Mexico, who have won their primaries and are looking very good in their races for those governor seats, are such tremendously strong candidates. But it takes a lot. It's a hard paradigm to shift when it comes to executive leadership still.
Why is that, Dave, in your view? I mean, why are the numbers so much lower in these executive positions?
I think there are a couple of reasons. I think when Julie talks about how voters may think about the qualities of a legislator versus the qualities of an executive, sometimes they sort of pigeonhole women as better suited for the legislative role as being more collaborative and less decisive. But I also think that one of the things we're seeing this year is a lot of the women running for the House, including a lot of the really strong candidates, are women who have not held elective office before. You know, some of them are military veterans, some of them are attorneys, some of them are people who worked in the nonprofit world or in academia, and they're trying to make that jump. And it's easier to make the jump into the House of Representatives or a state legislature from a non-political or non-elective position. It's a little bit more of a leap to go all the way to Senate or all the way to governor in one go. And so what we may see is women who are successful in lower offices this year may be setting up gains for women in Senate and governor's races in future elections.
Julie, let me ask you about the news around Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. On Monday, he'll testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee along with Christine Blasey Ford. She alleges that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were in high school. And it brings to mind the 1991 testimony of Anita Hill, who alleged that then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her. What followed was the so-called Year of the Woman in 1992, when an unprecedented number of women were elected to Congress. Do you expect this current Supreme Court fight to have a similar effect on this election?
Well, I think women voters and candidates, but you know, we saw voters in Virginia, for example, are already so highly motivated by what they've seen coming out of the Trump administration and really positions of leadership across the board, media companies, hotel chains, you name it. And so it's been this sort of slow burn all along, this assault on women's rights and the feeling like they've been constantly under attack that really began with the election of Donald Trump, of course, and then you know, we had the Women's March where women could see in their own communities that they weren't alone. And then that led pretty much immediately into the healthcare fight, where women were the ones making the phone calls and to into their members of Congress and trying to prevent the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which was a tremendous show of activism, and it was successful in the defeat of the repeal bill. And then that sort of led right into this the explosion of the Me Too movement and Time's Up, and it's been sort of one thing after another, and it's been building all along, so this will undoubtedly add fuel to the fire that many women are feeling, that this administration that is pushing through this nomination in an abnormal way to achieve a political goal of a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court is totally unacceptable.
All right. Well, that's Julie McLean Downey. She's National Director of Campaign Communications with Emily's List. She joined us from Washington. Julie, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Anthony.
And Dave Hopkins, a professor of political science at Boston College who studies American political parties and elections. Dave Hopkins, thank you as well.
Oh, anytime, Anthony.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's return to Lori Trahan's very narrow victory in the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District in Massachusetts. It came after a chaotic election that included a crowded field of 10 candidates, then election night chaos, 2 weeks of uncertainty, and a recount. In the end, Trahan won by just 145 votes, capturing less than 21% of the vote. Some elections observers say, "What a mess!" And they ask, is there a better way to run an election? Yes, say advocates of ranked choice voting. In fact, they say this election is the poster child for why ranked choice voting makes so much sense. Among those advocates is Drew Penrose. He's the law and policy director for Fair Vote, a Maryland-based electoral reform organization. Drew Pence, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
Can you explain briefly how ranked choice voting works for listeners who may not know?
Absolutely. So ranked choice voting is simple. You vote in a ranked choice voting election just like any other election. You've got the name of the candidate, and you mark the candidate that you like the most. However, you gain the ability to rank backup choices. So this is my first choice, but if they can't win, this is my second choice, and so on. Third choice, fourth choice, however many candidates happen to be in the contest. That way, you can count up the votes, and if there's a big split among a large field of candidates, like we saw in that primary election, then the candidate in last place can be eliminated. And if your first choice is eliminated, your vote is instantly added to the votes of your next choice, rather than being wasted. And you just repeat that process. It's an instant runoff. Basically.
I see, an instant runoff, and until you get to a situation where one candidate has a majority of the votes. Is that right?
Exactly. That's right. So you get the benefits of those runoff elections, that majority rule, without the need for that second election and without the reduced turnout that we see in runoff elections. So people in general get a much stronger voice in a single decisive election.
All right. So what advantages does it have over the current system we employ? And talk specifically about that third district race that we were talking about in the first break, you know, where we had 10 candidates and after this long, complicated system and a recount and everything, Lori Trahan wins with just 21% of the vote.
Yes. And we see crowded fields every election cycle. This one has really been special. Democrats are being drawn to these primary elections, and so we're seeing it a lot in Democratic primaries. It does happen in Republican primaries as well, where a large field of candidates all decide to participate, which is a good thing, right? It shows excitement, more people having different perspectives on what governance should look like in their political parties, and a good thing for voters to have more choices. But then if they can't identify which are the two front runners, then they run into this problem where they don't know if they vote for a candidate, if that candidate has any chance of winning, will their vote wind up being wasted? You hear people express that concern sometimes. And people have to engage in a lot of strategic voting to decide who they're going to vote for. If it's very difficult to do with these larger fields, then you can wind up with a situation where a candidate wins with a low plurality, And that causes all sorts of problems. In a primary election, it can kind of undermine the goal of the party unifying around a strong nominee. If we had done a round-by-round process and seen that the winner had majority support, that candidate would go into the general election from a much stronger position.
But isn't it true, though? I mean, or correct me if I'm wrong, but with ranked choice voting, wouldn't it be possible for someone who might have finished second or third, say, in the first round of voting, could actually emerge as the winner at the end of the sort of instant runoff process that ranked voting does?
That can happen, and the fact that that's possible in a single-choice plurality election like this primary election was raises doubts as to whether the quote-unquote right candidate won. We can't really know which of the candidates would have won in a head-to-head contest when people were only allowed to express one preference. It's a lot clearer when you look at partisan races that are done this way. So Maine recently adopted ranked choice voting, and the effort for that came after a governor's election in which a Democrat and an independent split the vote, and the Republican governor, Paul LePage, currently governor of Maine, was elected with something like 38% of the vote. So that's, you know, more than 60% of voters who feel like they, in some sense, voted against that candidate, but weren't able to elect a candidate that they preferred instead. Now, whether ranked choice voting would have changed the outcome is something we can never know, but people come out of that feeling like it could have, and that's a real problem.
Let me ask you about one or two of the concerns that I've read about and just get you to respond. The sort of most basic one is that voting should be super easy. I mean, it should be really transparent. And counting, tabulating ballots should be really straightforward as well. And if you have a crowded field and you have to go into a voting booth and sort of put in order six different candidates, that's not so easy.
So this is an interesting point. This is a worry that we hear from people for whom ranked choice voting is a new idea. However, when you look at places using ranked choice voting, you know, this isn't a new idea. It's been in use now for over 100 years somewhere. And there are currently 11 cities using ranked choice voting. The state of Maine now, five more have adopted it and will be implementing it in their next election cycles. And when we see ranked choice voting in action, what we see is that voters do rank their choices. In exit polls, when they come out of the voting booth, they often say that they like ranked choice voting. Hmm. In Maine, we didn't even need an exit poll because in the very same election in which they ranked their choices in the primary election, they also voted on a ballot question on whether they wanted to keep ranked choice voting for future elections. And a clear majority voted yes.
Hmm.
So there you have people using ranked choice voting and immediately saying, yes, I like this. I want to keep using it.
Right.
So that's really what we're seeing coming out of it. The results, what I would say is when you have a split field and people feel like maybe the wrong candidate won in some sense, that can cause much more of a concern with legitimacy of the outcome than seeing a round-by-round contest. When the results are displayed in a way that's clear and comprehensible, we see that voters don't have a problem with it.
Drew Penrose, one more question. We only have about 10 or 15 seconds left, but one more question. What's the resistance to it? I mean, your challenge is to convince a pretty entrenched political system to change, and that's difficult to do, right?
That's right. Ranked choice voting is still a new idea for a lot of people. And the number one concern we hear isn't so much any complaint about ranked choice voting per se, but rather just a sort of fear that something new might have unintended consequences.
Right.
Fortunately, as momentum for ranked choice voting is moving forward, we're getting more and more data on places that are actually using it. So the figures that I was able to mention before, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico, used ranked choice voting in their mayoral elections for the very first time earlier this year. And a mayoral field of six candidates, over 90% of voters ranked all six. Majority came out saying they liked it, wanted to keep using it, even wanted to extend it statewide. So the more and more places use ranked choice voting, the more familiar people get with it, the more we're seeing that those concerns are being resolved for a lot of people.
Well, Drew Penrose is the law and policy director for Fair Vote, a Maryland-based electoral reform organization. He was talking about ranked choice voting. Drew Penrose, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In New England, a rainy spring and a hot, humid summer have produced an early bumper crop crop of fruiting fungi, otherwise known as mushrooms. While many of us overlook these plants, researchers here in Boston say they play a critical role in regulating the global climate. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman reports on how the future of humanity may depend in large measure on the fate of fungi.
Some say fungi, some fungi. Whatever you call them, they're among the most tenacious forms of life on or off the planet. They've been found growing outside an orbiting spacecraft, thriving inside the ruins of the Chernobyl reactor, even in rocks in Antarctica. But it's on forest floors where fungi reign supreme. Biologically distinct from animals, plants, and bacteria, fungi are classified with their own kingdom. This is a perfect place for mushroom hunting. Decaying leaves and fallen twigs snap and crunch underfoot. The sandy loam soil anchors stunted oak and pine.
I love Wellfleet. I mean, this is my favorite town to be in on the Cape in mushroom season.
Wesley Price builds high-end homes on Cape Cod, but come fall, he forages the forest searching for mushrooms. The above-ground fruit of some species of fungi come in a wild variety of shapes, sizes, and psychedelic colors.
That's a great mushroom.
What is this? This looks like a fan or something.
Yeah, that's a velvet-footed pax. That's a Paxillus atrotomentosis.
That's easy for Price to say. He's been studying and foraging mushrooms since college and is founder of the Cape Cod Mycological Society.
Takes a unique personality type to want to walk through the woods and collect your food.
That would be you.
Yeah, and you.
And my father-in-law, Edward Gavarushko. This spot in Wellfleet is a jealously guarded secret that attracts in-the-know Eastern European mushroom hunters. Gavarushko is armed with a short knife and wicker basket.
Kalpak kolchty paruski.
Oh, yeah. No, this is a gypsy mushroom. This is a great edible mushroom. I love this one.
Russian kalpak kolchty.
Yeah, Cortinarius caparatus.
And this is good eating.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's not a beginner mushroom. If you don't know about mushroom stuff, you shouldn't. This is like, could be confused with other poisonous species.
People can only eat a few types of mushrooms, but some species of fungi can eat just about anything, from nerve gas to plastics. Fungi and bacteria are nature's recyclers. They feast on dead and decaying plants and animals, transforming the fungi food into essential nutrients and elements plants require.
I think we're just beginning to understand how critical they are.
How so?
Because of the ecological balance that they help maintain. If you have a healthy soil with plenty of fungi and microbes, you have the pieces that are necessary to support life.
No fungi, no life. The fate of the Earth's climate literally hangs by threads produced by fungi. These ultra-fine filaments of cells help forests store climate-changing carbon in the ground. The complex process is not well understood by scientists, who estimate there are as many as 3.8 million species of fungi, but so far they've identified just 120,000.
Six lifetimes wouldn't be enough to explore the kingdom of fungi, because there's so many species of fungi and so few people studying them. There's a researcher out of Boston University. She did research on fungi and climate change and still is ongoing in her lab. Pretty fascinating stuff.
The real area where fungi are influencing climate is by influencing the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere.
BU chemist Jennifer Bhatnagar says just a tiny pinch of soil can contain several hundred fungal species, many that help regulate global warming emissions.
The way they do it is by pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it below ground.
Thanks to fungi, there's twice as much carbon locked in the ground as in the atmosphere. One square meter of healthy soil can contain 12,000 miles of tangled fungi filament.
So essentially, the more fungi grow in soil, the more carbon dioxide can be drawn out of the atmosphere.
Fungi are subterranean climate change warriors, minute chemical factories that produce an array of powerful enzymes. Professor Bhatnagar keeps hundreds of species gathered from around the world stacked in petri dishes, ready to serve science.
So this is our culture collection here in this walk-in cold room.
Growing fungi in a lab is difficult because it's impossible to replicate the complex community of plants and microorganisms that communicate chemically in a forest. In nature, it's a delicate network that depends on the temperature of the soil.
So climate change is really disrupting these communities and their ability to cycle carbon and their ability to store carbon potentially. That's an area we're trying to understand more.
BU professor Pamela Templer tries to make the complex fungi climate connection simple. She draws a picture of what scientists call the carbon cycle, the interaction of trees, fungi, soil, and sky. Templer is a forest ecologist. She's especially interested in what are called mycorrhizal fungi. These play a critical role in the carbon cycle for about 85% of plant life.
If some alien came in and zapped all of the mycorrhizal fungi and they disappeared, I think we'd see a major shift in what plants we see around here.
Today, we're the aliens. When we burn fossil fuels, we pollute the air with nitrogen, which rains down on forests and acts like fertilizer, upsetting the mycorrhizal fungi's ability to store carbon. The CO2 that's emitted from the fuels also creates a greenhouse effect. The atmosphere and soil heat up.
When it's warmer, we see faster rates of decomposition of all those branches, roots, leaves, frogs, birds, whatever, anything that was alive that's on the forest floor, and an increase in how much carbon dioxide is leaving the soils, no longer being stored there, and boom, going back to the atmosphere.
It's a forest-destroying, climate-disrupting feedback loop. Warmer temperature, less snowfall. Exposed ground in winter freezes faster, deeper, longer, stunting tree growth and the storage of carbon.
Overall, we're seeing a greater increase in soil losses of carbon dioxide. The net effect is what we're trying to quantify right now.
Preliminary results from Templer's experimental plot in a New Hampshire forest suggest that if scaled up for the entire New England region, the amount of carbon stored in fungi in forest soil would be reduced by 20%, further accelerating the climate change feedback loop and increasing the possibility of runaway global warming. Again, mushroom expert Wesley Price.
We live on a very delicately balanced planet. We're really fragile. We're much more fragile than you think we are.
If Earth has a future, lowly fungi, unseen, underfoot, and still not well understood, will play a crucial role in maintaining that delicate balance.
And that story from WBUR's Bruce Gellerman from the WBUR Fungi Desk. Massachusetts has much to brag about, including a booming innovation economy, low unemployment, and incomes that are among the highest in the country. But the state also has some of the highest rates of economic inequality, a fact we've known about for some time. Now comes more data from the U.S. Census Bureau that further describes this vexing challenge. Evan Horowitz has taken a close look at these numbers. He's the Boston Globe's Quick Study columnist, a Radio Boston regular. Welcome back, Evan. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks, Anthony. It's an honor to be associated with fungi.
Okay, we're going to move on from fungi and talk about this data, which shows that by many measures, the Massachusetts economy is humming along. But when it comes to the middle class income, as you write, middle class income growth, poverty reduction, and health insurance coverage, the state is lagging behind. Right? What did it
find? It's not what you want to see. It's not what I expected to see. But yeah, households in the middle of the income distribution did not see significant income gains in 2017, which they should have, given that unemployment was dropping and the economy was doing quite well. And people at the bottom of the income ladder also seem to be struggling.
Mm. So if the economy as a whole is so strong, and we hear about this all the time, there are all kinds of numbers that indicate that it is, why are typical household incomes not really growing along with it?
Well, I mean, that is the big question. It's important to realize that it's a fundamental question. That is, when people say GDP is growing or the economy is growing, what they really mean is there's more money, there's more wealth around than there used to be. So that income, it's going somewhere. It's going into somebody's pocket. And if people in the middle of the income distribution aren't getting it, it means somebody else is. I mean, there's no way around that. So the first thing to look at is who's getting it? And it does seem like people towards the top were the ones who captured most of the gains in 2017. There are a couple ways to see that. One is that there was an increase in the number of households earning over $200,000. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish we could break that down further. We don't yet have, I mean, was it over 500,000? Was it over a million? I mean, $200,000 in Massachusetts is not all that much money. It's, you know, upper middle class, very upper middle, whatever it is. But it's a sign that a lot of the money was going to the top. The other is we have this very fancy measure of inequality called the Gini coefficient.
Now tell us what that is.
Well, I would, but it involves way too much math for radio listeners. But basically, it is the most well-regarded total measure of inequality. If you want inequality in a number, that's the number. And it jumped significantly in Massachusetts in 2017. And that's just another sign of where the money went, not into the pockets of people in the middle, but into the pockets of those at the top.
So let me throw a theory at you that I heard a while back. We've been talking about economic inequality in Greater Boston for many years. So there's this theory that you can look at it, that there's this theory that says, and it sounds cold-hearted in a way, that in fact, it's a good thing because it means lots of people are doing very well at the top and that lots of people at the bottom of the economic ladder have chosen to come here because there are lots of services. There are housing, there's housing, there are other benefits that make this a reasonably attractive place for people to get started and to start moving up that economic ladder. But of course, in so doing, it increases the gap between those highest earners and the lowest earners. So, do you buy that at all?
No.
Okay, next question.
Yeah, no, I don't buy that. It's certainly true that it's a good thing that the economy is doing well. And a thriving economy should have some distribution of people who are doing exceedingly well and people who are moving up. We had such a distribution when the economy was much more equal in the 60s and the 70s. There were much wealthier people and there were much poorer people. But the degree to which that has tilted since then is, let's say, unnecessary to a thriving economy. So I think the bigger issues in terms of why we're having inequality is not like it's necessary to economic growth, but the power of workers and the power of middle-class families to negotiate for better pay has been eroded over time. Partly that's the decline of unions. Partly it's the consolidation in industries. Like, you know, there used to be lots of pharmacies, and now there are basically two. And so it's harder to sort of get your employer to pay you more by threatening to go work for a competitor. So it's things like that, I think, that seem to be driving inequality, even in Massachusetts.
Another question I have about this that I'd love to hear your views on is inequality. And by the way, in laying out that theory that I just laid out to ask you about, with which you strenuously and forcefully disagreed.
It wasn't personal.
No. And I'm not saying I buy into that. It's just something that has made me think when someone sort of put it to me. But another idea is inequality isn't the problem. A lack of mobility is the problem. In other words, if you have economic inequality, but you have the means by which people can move up that ladder more easily, then the issue of inequality is less severe.
That might be. I don't really think you have to choose. They could both be problems, and they both are problems. That is, inequality makes mobility harder because it makes jumping between parts of the ladder that much more difficult.
Yeah.
And it reinforces power. As people gain more and more money towards the top of the ladder, they can use that money to reinforce their social power by, say, lobbying for changes in tax laws that will help them and not those at the bottom. So it actually undermines mobility. There's also all kinds of crazy research, and we won't get into this, that no society has basically ever had mobility, that the same families who are at the top of the income ladder in Sweden in the 15th century are there today. It's really interesting research, and that mobility is kind of a myth. I will say also this, because it's not just about the middle class and the top. We also have this problem with poverty in Massachusetts. The rest of the country saw a big drop in the poverty rate in 2017, a really substantial decrease. And Massachusetts didn't, not at all. And
now, what explains that?
So that one I found sort of the most surprising, also the most kind of disturbing, because you really expect that when an economy is doing well, as ours is, and when the unemployment rate is dropping, that should mean more people who didn't have jobs now have jobs. And those people who didn't have jobs, they were more likely to be in poverty. Now they have jobs, they should be moving out of poverty. If they're not, it means either wages aren't what you hope, or it means really poverty is a problem that is just separate from the job market. Poverty is a problem that we often think of it as about workers who need money, but actually maybe it's not. It's about kids, it's about people in school, it's about seniors. And actually, the majority of people living in poverty do fit these non-working categories. They're people who we wouldn't even want to work because they're students or they're caretakers or they're seniors. And getting them out of poverty isn't about a better job market. It's about something else.
Boy, thank you for coming in and sharing these numbers.
And depressing
that made me feel a whole lot less confident about the world around me. But important stuff from Evan Horowitz. He's the quick study columnist for the Boston Globe and a Radio Boston regular. His column on the new census data is entitled So Much for the Massachusetts Miracle. We'll have a link to that at radioboston.org. Evan, thanks again.
Oh, it's great being here.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Boston is one step closer today to having a new memorial to honor the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the slain civil rights leader, and Coretta Scott King, who met in Boston. The nonprofit MLK Boston, in partnership with the city, unveiled five designs today to remember and honor the couple's relationship. In addition to the monument, the group plans to create a new educational center in Roxbury to train activists and to start an endowment for MLK-inspired programming at the 12th Baptist Church. To tell us more about all this, we have Maria Garcia in the studio. She's senior editor of The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. And it's good to see you, Maria. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Anthony.
So why commemorate the relationship between the Kings instead of, say, his time as a pastor, an organizer, or a student in Boston?
Well, Anthony, I don't think you can talk about Martin Luther King Jr. in Boston without talking about Coretta. He arrived here in 1951. He met her only a few months later in January of 1952. And Coretta's legacy over the years has been really tethered to Martin. But when they met, she was more politically involved than he was. And after his death, she did more than just protect her husband's legacy. I think she really expanded it and kept it relevant. And everything Martin accomplished, he did so because Coretta wasn't his helpmate, as she has so often been portrayed, but I think his equal partner. And none of the memorials really capture that.
Right. Really interesting. And Maria, you put together a lovely report on their relationship, how it started in Boston. So let's listen to a little bit of that and then come back and talk some more.
In a way, Boston is the place where Martin Luther King Jr. accelerated his life's work as a civil rights leader.
This is the first time he sort of stepped outside the limelight of his father. His father was quite a powerful and popular minister, Martin Luther King Sr. And Boston is really the place that Martin established his identity as a leading thinker, philosopher, as a religious leader.
That's Paul English, the entrepreneur who founded MLK Boston, the nonprofit working with the city to build the King Memorial on the Boston Common.
And it's here that he met Coretta. They fell in love here. They dated. They courted in Boston. When they got married, this is where they begin their lives as newlyweds.
King Jr. came to Boston in 1951 to earn his PhD at Boston University. And by January 1952, he dated quite a bit. He wrote in his autobiography that he had started to become cynical because he wasn't particularly fond of the women he'd met. Here's Reverend Liz Walker, pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian Church and co-chair of MLK Boston.
He courted lots of women in Boston. I don't want to say he was a playboy, but he was looking for a wife. So he met lots of other women, but she rose beyond them all.
A mutual friend introduced King Jr. to Coretta Scott, who was studying at the New England Conservatory of Music.
When they met, he fell in love almost instantly. She did not, and I love that. Yeah. So he had to kind of court her.
King Jr. wrote that he knew he wanted to marry Coretta after their very first lunch together, when they spoke about social justice. Coretta was already an activist in her own right when she met King Jr. She grew up in Marion, Alabama, where white neighbors burned her childhood home. And though her father owned land, and later a general store, she still faced poverty.
She came up in really horrible situation concerning race, growing up in Alabama and, you know, having to pick cotton and really kind of struggling as a child. And her own sensibility about justice was profound because of her roots.
Martin and Coretta married in June of 1953. She made the word obey be deleted from their vows, a rather anomalous demand for a 1950s wife. And their life as a joint force for justice began in Boston. Both of them from the South, they recognized the more progressive attitudes of the North, but also its cloaked racism.
And the estrangement of the races in the North can be as devastating as the segregation of the races in the South. It is one thing for a white person of goodwill in the North to rise up with righteous indignation when a bus is burned in Anniston, Alabama, with freedom riders.
This is Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at a Ford Hall forum in Boston in 1963.
But it is just as necessary and important for white persons of goodwill in the North to rise up with righteous indignation when a Negro cannot live in their community or their neighborhood because of certain restrictions and agreements.
And later, Coretta, still mourning her husband's death, took his place at Harvard's Class Day in 1968, the first woman to do so, calling on mostly white students to mobilize against injustice.
Your generation must speak out with righteous indignation against the forces which are seeking to destroy us.
Erecting a memorial of the Kings on the Common ensures they take their rightful place in Boston's storied history, says MLK Boston founder Paul English.
I mean, I think if you look at the Freedom Trail and think about who was honored on that, I think Martin Luther King should be honored equally, if not more, as one of the leaders who've come out of Boston.
Reverend Liz Walker says the memorial is also a call to action, a reminder that the King's work is not finished here.
That battle is ongoing, that what the King stood for is still real right now. It's almost as if their voices are as strong today as they were back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
And the Reverend Liz Walker ending that report from WBUR's Maria Garcia, who's back with us live in the studio to talk about what the memorial on Boston Common might look like. And Maria, tell us first about the five designs that were unveiled today. What sets them apart?
So, Anthony, I'm going to try my best to describe them, but I should tell you we have renderings on WBUR.org that do them justice. Mm-hmm. But let's start with the first one. It's called Empty Pulpit Monument. It's by artist Barbara Chase Ribou. So it's like an empty stone pulpit with a searchlight beacon erected on top. Then there's artist Hank Willis Thomas. His design for the memorial is a 22-foot-high bronze sculpture of the arms of both MLK Jr. and Coretta Scott King embracing each other and also enveloping visitors below them. Then we have Yinka Shonibare, and their design is called Avenue of Space, which is a walkway with a 30-foot mosaic fountain in the middle and then inscribed benches surrounding it.
Well, they all sound pretty impressive. And two of the potential memorials are designed by artist-architect teams, right?
Right. So all these artists are working with either a design firm or a gallery or an architectural firm. Christoph Wodiska and Julian Bonder, they're an artist and professor team from Cambridge. They designed two beacon towers that light an amphitheater and mounds for public seating on the Common. Then artist Pendleton is working with David Ajay, and he's the architect, actually, Anthony, who designed the National Museum of African American History that's fairly new in Washington, D.C. And that plan would build a raised open structure of black stone, kind of looks like a big bridge that would also serve as a platform and amphitheater for residents to look onto the Common.
Wow. Now, on Radio Boston about a year ago, we spoke with Paul English, who founded MLK Boston, about what he envisions for the memorial. So here's what he had to say.
I would like to make sure that visitors, whether it's local Boston residents or tourists from out of town, when they come upon this memorial, I want to make sure they're inspired, but they're also challenged a little bit.
What do you think he meant by that? I mean, how do you think these pieces challenge their viewers? And do any one of the designs accomplish this more than the others, in your view?
Well, Anthony, all of these pieces are very, very conceptual. Every material, every detail symbolizes something. For example, the empty pulpit in artist Barbara Chase Ribou's piece symbolizes MLK's silenced voice. The raised bridge in Adam Pendleton's design represents sort of a spatial metaphor, the mountaintop that the King spoke about, where you can see the history of past struggles. So when you learn a little bit about the sculptures, it does make you contemplate the King's legacy more deeply. But then there's also just like the physicality of these pieces. They're imposing and big. And I think that kind of halting grandness in public spaces can be really powerful.
Hmm. Now, the public has an opportunity to comment on all five of these designs, but it's going to be up to MLK Boston's Arts Committee that will make the final decision here. How much do you think the public's input will have on the, I mean, how much input will the public have on the final choice?
Well, you know, I can't really speculate on that. But I can tell you, Anthony, that I don't think MLK Boston would have had more than a dozen community meetings and expanded its plans as a response to that public input if it wasn't taking the community's comments in good faith. Also, though, Paul English told me that popularity doesn't necessarily equal good public art. So MLK Boston is taking into consideration public input, but it's also using art history, aesthetic value, timelessness, and other themes to inform its decision.
Well, really interesting project. That's Maria Garcia. She's the senior editor of The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. Thanks, Maria. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony. My pleasure.
And the plans are now on view at the Boston Public Library in Copley Square and the Bruce C. Bowling Municipal Building in Dudley Square until October 16th. You can also check them out at our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.